This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News, covering Gardner and the towns of Ashburnham, Hubbardston, Petersham, Templeton, Westminster, and Winchendon. This program is sponsored in part by the Lions Clubs of Ashburnham, Petersham, and Winchendon. And thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, we will be bringing you news from the Gardner News, covering the week of July 2nd through July 8th. This is Dave Russell reading with Alexandra Zapantis. Our first story, Gardner family displaced by fire as community fundraising effort grows. This is written by Stephen Landry. A GoFundMe account has been started for the residents displaced by a fire in Gardner on the 4th of July. Firefighters responded to a reported house fire at 171 Regan Street just before 11:30 p.m. on Saturday, July 4th, according to Fire Chief Greg LeGoy. The first firefighters on scene saw heavy smoke showing from the front of the single-family home and immediately struck a second alarm to bring off-duty Gardner firefighters and mutual aid companies to the scene. The exterior fire was quickly knocked down but had already spread inside the building, causing extensive damage to the building's first and second floors, LeGoy said. Five occupants and one dog were able to escape the house prior to the arrival of the firefighters and were not injured, LeGoy said. One firefighter was transported to Haywood Hospital with a leg injury, but it does not appear to be serious, said LeGoy. The building was declared uninhabitable, and the Red Cross was assisting the displaced occupants, according to LeGoy. A GoFundMe account, created by Donald Schofield, had raised over $9,000 of its $18,000 goal by Monday afternoon. According to the account's description, the occupants, Kevin and Claudia Schofield, along with their two daughters, lost most of their belongings in the blaze. As a family member, I'm reaching out to our community to help them recover from this unexpected tragedy, Donald wrote. The loss has left them in urgent need of clothing, essentials, and a safe place to stay while they rebuild their lives. Investigators from the Massachusetts Fire District 8 Regional Fire Investigation Unit determined the cause of the fire was likely to be from an electrical short circuit on the front porch of the dwelling. The blaze did not appear to be fireworks-related, according to LeGoy. Firefighters remained on scene for about 4 hours. Mutual aid was received from Westminster, Ashburnham, Hubbardston, Winchendon, Templeton, and Fitchburg at the scene. Coverage at the Gardner Station was provided by fire departments from Athol, Leominster, and Devons. Our next story, Gardner man accused of stealing switching medicines at care facility. This is written by Henry Schwann of the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. A central Massachusetts man allegedly stole prescription medicines meant for patients in hospice and memory care units. Andrew Milgram, 37, of Gardner, is expected to plead guilty to a charge of tampering with consumer products, according to the Office of Massachusetts U.S. Attorney Leah Foley. Milgram allegedly swallowed oxycodone pills intended for patients in skilled nursing and dementia care units in a Fitchburg healthcare facility, according to court records. The pills were replaced with loratadine, an allergy medication that resembles 5-milligram oxycodone pills. Milgram also allegedly diverted 10-milligram oxycodone pills from an elderly patient in a locked unit and replaced them with levothyroxine, a thyroid medication. The diversions allegedly happened in 2024 and 2025. Milgram faces up to 10 years in jail and 3 years of supervised release, plus a fine that could reach $250,000. That according to Foley's office. Now we turn to this story from Gardner, Mount Wachusett Community College members recognized for public safety. This is written by Kimberly Green, an AI-assisted reporter. Two members of the Mount Wachusett Community College community were recently recognized for their contributions to public safety, according to a community announcement. John Bresnahan, paramedic program clinical coordinator, was named Central Mass EMS Educator of the Year. Templeton police officer Caleb Mattson, a graduate of MWCC's criminal justice program, received the First Responder of the Year award. The EMS Educator of the Year Award recognizes outstanding contributions to paramedicine education and honors educators who demonstrate excellence in teaching, mentorship, and professional leadership. John has been vital to MWCC in the development and launch of our Associate Degree in Paramedicine program, Kim Shea, Dean of Nursing and Health Sciences, said in the announcement. This recognition reflects his dedication, professionalism, and lasting impact on education and student success. Mattson was honored as First Responder of the Year for his response at the scene of a motorcycle crash involving severe traumatic injuries to the driver. His quick assessment, decisive actions, and emergency care helped stabilize the victim during a critical situation. A graduate of MWCC's criminal justice program, Mattson is the son of Kathy Mattson, MWCC's director of student life. He has built a career centered on protecting and serving his community. These honors reflect the extraordinary dedication, professionalism, and commitment to service that define the Mount Wachusett Community College community, MWCC President James Vanderhoeven said in the announcement. John Bresnahan's leadership in paramedicine education is helping prepare the next generation of paramedics, while Officer Mattson's life-saving actions demonstrate the profound impact our alumni have in the community they serve. We are incredibly proud of both of them and grateful for the difference they make every day. And this story from Gardner, 123 Grow Child Center begins rebuilding in Gardner months after fire. This is written by Stephen Landry. 6 months after a devastating fire destroyed the 123 Grow Child Center's campus in Gardner, the company's officials announced plans to rebuild the facility at 838 West Broadway. The debris of the destroyed building has been hauled away, and construction equipment is on site preparing the property for rebuilding. Yes, the work you are seeing at West Broadway does reflect the beginning stages of restoration after the fire, said Corey Owen, regional manager for the company that also has locations in Hubbardston, Barry, Athol, Fitchburg, Leominster, and Worcester. It is an important step forward in the rebuilding process, and we are grateful to be moving forward into this phase. Officials were actively coordinating with all relevant parties to move the restoration process forward, according to Owen. And while the full scope and timeline are still being finalized, we are working toward reopening as soon as safely possible, she said. The new facility will be designed to closely reflect the previous center, with our primary focus on creating a safe, nurturing, and enjoyable learning environment for children, a welcoming home away from home for our staff, and a place that gives parents complete peace of mind when they drop off their children while they are at work, Owen said. The contractor for the project is working on the permitting process, and an exact opening date has not yet been set. Nobody was in the structure when the fire started in the building's attic area during the frigid early morning hours of January 29th. According to fire department officials, firefighters were hampered by the extreme cold temperatures and deep snow conditions that caused equipment to freeze and ice to quickly form around the scene. Two firefighters suffered minor injuries that did not require transport to the hospital. Investigators determined the fire began in the attic, where a propane heating system was in place, according to Jake Wark, spokesman for the state fire marshal's office. They identified two potential factors, including an electrical event for the use of heat tape that had been used for a frozen pipe, but because they could not rule out either of them, the cause will remain officially undetermined, he said. They found no evidence of an intentionally set fire, though. Owen said she and her staff members were grateful for the outpouring of support from the community over the past several months. The support from our families and the broader community has been truly overwhelming in the best way, she said. It has played a major role in helping our team stay focused and motivated throughout this process. We are deeply grateful for the continued encouragement. Owen thanked the center's parents and families for their patience and trust during the rebuilding process. Seeing the construction begin is a positive milestone, and we are committed to keeping everyone informed as we move forward step by step, she said. We have some upcoming events in our communities. Red Apple Farm hosts annual Blueberry Festival. This is written by Kimberly Green, an AI-assisted reporter. Families can enjoy blueberry picking, live music, and homemade treats at Red Apple Farm's annual Blueberry Jamboree, according to a community announcement. The festival is set for 2 weekends, July 11th through 12th and July 18th to 19th, and features a variety of activities celebrating one of New England's favorite summer harvests. Pick Your Own Blueberries will be available from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., giving visitors plenty of time to head into the fields before or after enjoying the festival. Festival activities will run from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Guests can fill a bucket with fresh-picked blueberries, hop aboard the Blueberry Express hayrides, browse local artisan vendors, enjoy fresh blueberry treats, or relax in the cider garden while listening to live music. Throughout the day, families can join in Blueberry Bingo, test their skills in the Blueberry Donut on a String contest, cool off during the water balloon toss, and enjoy live music on the Cidery and Brew Barn stages. The festival opens at 10 a.m. At 11 a.m., it's Blueberry Bingo in the Cider Garden. At 12 noon, Blueberry Donut on a String contest in the Cider Garden. 1 o'clock, it's the Water Balloon Toss. From 2 to 4 in the afternoon, live music by Owen Daniel on the Cidery stage, and the festival concludes at 6 p.m. In addition to blueberry picking, the festival will feature a variety of family-friendly activities, including a blueberry scavenger hunt, jam jar guessing game, blueberry container decorating, and blueberry coloring pages. Local artisan vendors will be on hand, offering homemade blueberry treats, farm-fresh food, hard cider, and more. Whether you're visiting for the blueberries, the food, the music, or simply a fun summer outing with family and friends, there's something happening around every corner at the Blueberry Jamboree. And we have these event notes from a previously published story, Where to See Live Music This Summer in Greater Gardner. It's written by Stephen Landry, and he begins, There will be plenty of music in the air across Greater Gardner this summer. At Monument Park in Gardner, The Remedy, featuring Rob Gale and Jody Thompson, will play their unique blend of classic rock, country, and blues on the bandstand stage on Saturday, July 11th. The Traveling Homebodies will wow the crowd with their unique tribute to the Traveling Wilburys on Saturday, July 18th. And Dave Malowin, a local musician who specializes in rock and roll, country, and oldies, will be the featured act on Saturday, July 25th. That's at Monument Park in Gardner. At the Candlelight Cafe in Templeton, Nasty Habit, a Rolling Stones tribute band, will bring plenty of satisfaction to the Candlelight Cafe on Saturday, July 18th. Tickets for the show, which will go from 6 to 9 p.m., are $10 presale and $15 at the door. and The Verge. A dance party band will perform on Saturday, July 25th. Tickets for the show, which will go from 6 to 9 p.m., are $10 presale and $15 at the door. And there's a Concerts on the Common series in Templeton. All You'll Need Is Love when Forever Fab takes the stage to recreate the music of the Beatles on Sunday, July 19th. There is no rain date for this show. This is Community News from Gardner. It's a weekly production of the Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Now Alexandra Zapantis joins us. She has more Gardner news for you. Alexandra?
Thank you, Dave. Two-alarm fire leaves Gardner Buddhist Center uninhabitable. This is by Stephen Landry with the Gardner News. A two-alarm fire heavily damaged a Buddhist learning and meditation center in Gardner on Tuesday, June 30th. Officials received a report of a fire at the International Shakyamuni Buddha Vihara and Vipassana Center at 20 Lakewood Terrace at about 10:43 a.m., according to Chief Gregory Lagoy. Their fire started on the first floor, and there was heavy fire damage to the first floor and smoke and heat damage throughout the building, Lagoy said. The fire was quickly knocked down by crews. The building is occupied by three monks and a nun, according to Dr. Pragahaloik Bhikkhu, who owns the property. Only the nun, who was not identified, was home at the time of the fire. The nun attempted to douse the flames with a fire extinguisher before exiting the building, according to Bhikkhu. She was outside when we got here, and they did transport her to the hospital for evaluation, Lagoy said. Additional assistance from other departments, including Leominster and Westminster, was requested at the scene due to excessive heat, according to Lagoy. The fire caused hundreds of thousands of dollars of damage to the structure, which is uninhabitable, Lagoy said. My thoughts are with the members of the Gardner Buddhist community following the fire at their temple, monastery, meditation center this morning, said Mayor Michael Nicholson. All those living at the location made it out and are safe. The Red Cross has been called in to assist those living there while the structure is evaluated. The cause of the fire remained under investigation. Monks vow to rebuild Gardner Buddhist Learning Center damaged by fire. This is by Stephen Landry with the Gardner News. The cause of a two-alarm fire that caused extensive damage to a Buddhist learning and meditation center in Gardner on Tuesday, June 30th, was believed to be accidental, according to officials. Firefighters were called to the International Shakyamuni Buddha Vihara and Vipassana Center at 20 Lakewood Terrace at about 10:41 a.m., according to Fire Chief Greg Lagoy. The bulk of the fire was quickly knocked down by first arriving on-duty Gardner firefighters, but extensive overhaul was needed to extinguish pockets of fire that had extended into walls and ceilings, he said. Mutual aid was requested at the scene due to high temperatures and humidity, Lagoy explained, adding that such extreme factors required firefighters to limit their work time and rotate often, rehabilitating and rehydrating as often as possible. The blaze left the building uninhabitable, and the Red Cross is assisting the five occupants who are currently without a place to live. Displaced occupants assisted by Red Cross. According to Mayor Michael Nicholson, Dr. Pragilok Bhikkhu, who goes by Bhante, which is the Buddhist equivalent of Reverend, was at City Hall to provide an update on the situation. He's let me know that he, the three monks and one nun, have been given a few nights at a local hotel through the Red Cross and are going to be meeting on Sunday with the various Buddhist temples across Massachusetts to make a long-term plan for their building and operations, Nicholson said. A donation box to assist with the temple's rebuilding and the costs associated with finding temporary shelter will be placed in the rotunda at City Hall with the city's permission, according to Nicholson. They are looking for other locations to place donation boxes as well, he said. Fire believed to be accidental. All off-duty Gardner firefighters were recalled to duty and mutual aid was received from Westminster, Winchingdon, Ashburnham, Hubbardston, Templeton, Fitchburg, and Leominster at the scene. Gardner Fire Headquarters were covered by Rutland, Stirling, Athol, and Orange, according to LaGoy. Although the cause of the fire is undetermined, it is believed to be accidental. The investigation was conducted by the State Fire District 8 Fire Investigation Unit and state troopers assigned to the State Fire Marshal's Office. Ashburnham Westminster Schools received $55,000 from local foundation. This is a staff report for the Gardner News. Students and teachers in the Ashburnham Westminster Regional School District will benefit from a record $55,582 in grant funding, according to a community announcement. The Ashburnham Westminster Foundation for Academic Excellence, AWFAE, distributed the funds to support educational programs and classroom needs across the district. The grants were awarded by Dave Uminski, AWFAE Grants Committee Chair, and Chris Wells, AWFAE President, according to the announcement. The $55,582 in grant awards is the largest annual total in the foundation's history, according to the announcement. The previous record was $32,353, awarded during the 2018 through 2019 school year. Since its founding in 2009, AWFAE has raised more than $400,000 and funded over 120 grants, totaling $270,000. Our previous record was $32,353, awarded during the 2018 through 2019 school year. However, our average since the inception of the foundation in 2009 is just over $15,000 per year. This year was by far the most money we have awarded to the schools, said Wells. Uminski said this year's grant requests were among the best the foundation has ever received. The teachers really put a lot of thought into these grant requests, and we are very excited to see these funds go towards great programs that will help better prepare the students in the district for future success, Uminski said. Foundation aims to enhance education. AWFAE was founded by a group of parents and town residents to raise private money to fund grant requests for the school district. The foundation's mission is to support teaching and learning through gifts and grants that implement innovative ideas to enhance the lives of children in Ashburnham and Westminster. The pressure on public schools is as high as it has ever been, said Dr. Todd Stewart, AWRSD superintendent. Many towns surrounding us have been trying to pass overrides and are struggling to maintain the quality of education that is required. We are very lucky to have such a dedicated group of volunteers here in Ashburnham and Westminster who work hard to raise the money and work directly with our staff to fund programs that enhance academic excellence. We are truly investing in the future of our community. Community support drives fundraising efforts. Jeff Boudreau, AWFAE Vice President and Fundraising Chair, emphasized the importance of community support in the foundation's efforts. The majority of our fundraising takes place at our annual event, A Night for Excellence, which is held the Friday before Thanksgiving at the Colonial Hotel in Gardner or Wachusett Mountain Ski Area in Westminster and Princeton. We have a generous community that supports us. This story was created by Kimberly Green, K. Green, at usatodayco.com with the assistance of artificial intelligence, AI. Journalists were involved in every step of the information gathering, review, editing, and publishing process. Learn more at cm.usatoday.com/ethical-conduct. Phillipston rejects override, delaying Narragansett school budget. This is by Amelia Cardona with the Gardner News. This story has been updated to include additional information. After Phillipston voters did not pass a $208,020 school budget increase by the slimmest of margins on June 30th, Templeton and Phillipston will have to vote again on the Narragansett Regional School District budget at a district-wide town meeting. The ballot results were close, with 11 more votes against the override. 105 Phillipston residents voted yes on the override, while 116 voted no. Christopher Cassavon, superintendent of the Narragansett Regional School District, said district officials are disappointed with the outcome of the vote, but respect the voters' decision. Our focus now is on moving forward through the statutory budget process, including a district-wide meeting, while continuing to provide the best possible education for our students under the financial constraints of a 1/12 budget, he said. As of Wednesday, July 1st, until a budget is passed, the State Department of Elementary and Secondary Education is involved and will set a monthly spending limit, which is typically called a 1/12 budget. The district-wide meeting has not yet been announced. The fiscal 2027 school district budget number presented to Phillipston voters at annual town meeting was $2,490,509, but voters approved only $2,123,541. At Templeton's town meeting, voters approved the requested allocation of $10,052,160 for the Narragansett Regional School District. The two town school expenditures are based on each community's student population. Both towns must agree on a budget figure for the budget to pass. Templeton voters who already passed the fiscal year 27 school district budget must continue to wait before they can finalize their town's operating budget because Phillipston voters failed to pass the override. Weekend Roadside Stand brings homemade pantry items to Templeton. This is by Stephen Landry with the Gardner News. This story has been updated to correct an inaccuracy. Greater Gardner's newest roadside attraction is now open for business. Wildflower and Thread, located at 149 Hubbardston Road in Templeton, is a weekend roadside stand that will sell a variety of homemade items throughout the summer, including all-purpose spices, cookie and pancake mix, honey chapstick, sugar scrubs, room spray, and overnight oats. The stand, which accepts cash and Venmo and operates entirely on the honor system, is the creation of Cassidy Wong, who said she dreamed of starting her own business out of her love of crafting unique and personalized items. After leaving my career as a COA at D'Ambrosio Eye Care to become a stay-at-home mom to my two amazing kids, I decided to pursue something I'd always dreamed of, building a business of my own, said Wong, who is also the varsity cheerleading coach at Gardner High School. Wong decided that the stand, which is open Fridays through Mondays from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., would focus on providing dry mix homemade cooking items with items such as pancakes, muffins, brownies, cookies, and instant oatmeal. Farm stand owner inspired after reading labels on store-bought items. Mac and cheese will soon be available in response to public demand, Wong said. She also said she hoped the stand will eventually be able to accept card payments in the near future. Wong said she was inspired to open her own staple-based pantry farm stand when she became a mother and really began inspecting the food labels on products she purchased from the store. That led to my journey of learning to make all these store-bought items from scratch, she said. I began making homemade coffee syrups, using fresh ingredients and no artificial flavoring. I've made scratch Oreos, muffins, bagels, breads, tortillas, cakes, you name it. Wong even attempted to hop on the current sourdough trend, but decided that having two children under the age of two in the home made it too difficult. From there, I started a private Facebook group and shared all my homemade products, which everyone seemed to love, and eventually I took the chance on opening a roadside farm stand to be able to offer homemade, low-ingredient products to the community, she said. It's amazing to see and taste the difference in homemade products versus store-bought. Custom embroidery projects also available. Visitors to the stand will notice a box where messages can be left for Wong, who said she was eager to hear feedback from her customers. I would love to hear how they feel my products compare to store-bought brands, specifically if they notice the difference, she said. I would also love to continue to get inquiries for products they would love to see me offer. Even though the stand has only been open for a single weekend, Wong said she's already received some notes from customers. Some feedback I have gotten so far was specifically towards my all-purpose spice, which can be used on any meats, seafood, poultry, and veggies, and how good it was, she said. That was really great to hear. And now, back over to you, Dave.
Thank you, Alexandra. Our next story, new Fraps Buzz Blends expand menu at Izzy's Ice Cream. This is written by Amelia Cardona. Freshly squeezed lemonade, weekly special fraps, and 27 different unique ice cream flavors are just a few of the sweet, cool treats now on the menu at Izzy's Ice Cream in Templeton. This is the fourth season Izzy's has been open at 277 Gardner Road in Templeton, and they have several new items ready to satisfy any craving. Last year, in the summer of 2025, Nicole Bessie, co-owner and operator, said they added ice cream cakes, and that has been successful, so they decided to expand their menu even more. Bessie said this season they decided to stop serving handhelds like hot dogs and pretzels because they don't have the capacity in their trailer and focus more on frozen sweet treats. Fraps are now a staple of Izzy's menu, but they used to appear only when the stand had a special. Bessie said fraps are now a permanent menu item, and customers can choose any of the 27 ice cream flavors for their fraps. The ice cream stand will continue to highlight a special frap flavor each week, as well as an ice cream flavor of the month. Bessie said that for July, the ice cream flavor is cherry vanilla ice cream, and for the week of July 6th, the frap flavor is strawberry cheesecake. We wanted to think outside the box and highlight fun flavors through our fraps and other treats, she said. The girls and I just play around with ice cream flavors. We have to come up with the fraps every week. The new menu items include Kitty Sundaes, which come in four flavors, Vanilla Coke Classic Soda Float, Creamy or Frosted Lemonade, Buzz Blends, which are coffee beverages with two scoops of ice cream, and milkshakes. Bessie said that all the coffee used in their Buzz Blends is from Victoria's Coffee in Gardner, and all the baked goods used in their sundaes are from Deer Creek Bagel and Breads in Templeton. We use Victoria's coffee beans and Deer Creek cookies because supporting other small local businesses is important, she said. Also, getting fresh and locally made ingredients just makes our treats more special and tastes better. Izzy's Ice Cream is open 7 days a week from 2 p.m. to 9 p.m. From Winchendon, library hosts first indie author book fair. This is written by Kimberly Green, an AI-assisted reporter. Self-published authors are invited to share their work and connect with readers at the first Beals Indie Author Book Fair, according to a community announcement. The event is scheduled for September 19th from 10:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Beals Memorial Library, 50 Pleasant Street in Winchendon. The fair aims to celebrate the creativity and diversity of independent authors. The event will feature opportunities for authors to engage with fellow writers, connect with industry professionals, and reach a broader audience. Illustrators, editors, literary agents, small indie publishing houses, and printing companies are also invited to participate. Throughout the day, authors will have the chance to take the outdoor stage for readings or discussions about their work. Panels in the library auditorium will cover topics such as intro to publishing, how to get started, scams to avoid, and working with third-party contractors, artists, editors, and the like. Two workshops are also planned covering topics like EPUBs, Unzipped, and From Book to Audiobook. Authors and other vendors can reserve a 10-by-10-foot space to display and sell their work or offer services. Space is limited and available on a first-come, first-served basis. The vendor fee is by donation, with a minimum of $10 required. Those interested in a 15-minute on-stage slot for reading or presentation should indicate their preference on the online registration form. Registration is available at beelslibrary.org/bookfair. Registration closes July 31st. For more information, visit beelslibrary.org/bookfair or call the library at 978-297-0300. Here's a unique local story. Monty Tech students receive Royal Wave from King Charles. It's written by Stephen Landry. A group of Monty Tech students enjoyed a brief but memorable royal encounter during a recent trip to Europe. During a guided tour of London on June 24th, the group of 41 students and 8 chaperones stopped outside the gates of Buckingham Palace. There were other groups camped out there, and the group's tour guide casually mentioned that a sighting of King Charles III might be possible. The anticipation built a few minutes later when motorcycle police officers appeared and traffic was halted. Right before it happened, our tour guide explained what a royal moment was and told us that police would block off the streets whenever the king traveled, said student Audrina Vincent, adding the guide strategically positioned the group for a better view. A few minutes later, the palace gates opened to allow a motorcade to exit. King Charles was waving to us from the back seat of his car, said student Maddie Wolfrey. It was pretty surreal to see him in person. You hear so much about the royals in the news that they become like these mythical beings from fairy tales, so seeing him in real life was really amazing. I usually don't give much thought to the English royal family, but being there in the flesh and seeing his car pass by the gates was insane, said Carielle Gaskey. Everyone had their phones out, and so did I. But when that moment happened, I didn't actually look at my phone. I looked right in front of me, and it was King Charles. Megan Jakes caught the brief sighting on video. We were all told to have our cameras up and videoing once we saw the police on the motorcycles leaving, she said. But we were on the exact side the king sat on, which was insane. The encounter was exciting for tourists and locals alike, Vincent said. Our tour guide was so excited because it's not something they get to see very often either, she said. I never expected to witness something like that, so it was honestly surreal and exciting. It's definitely a once-in-a-lifetime experience I'll always remember. The trip, which was not a school-sponsored event, was organized by teacher Bethany Johnson through Explorica World Strides and was designed to immerse students in history, art, architecture, and culture through first-hand experiences. There's simply no substitute for standing in places where history happened, Johnson said. For many of our students, it was their first time traveling internationally, and it was amazing to watch their confidence and independence grow over the course of the trip. Seeing a reigning monarch was an unexpected highlight of the trip, which also included visits to France, Monaco, and Italy, according to Johnson. As the motorcade exited the palace, King Charles happened to have his window down, which we're told is fairly rare, and our students had a clear, close-up view as he passed by, Johnson said. It was one of those magical travel moments that you simply can't plan for. Next, we have a local sports story for you. Vote for Gardner Area Boys Track and Field Athlete of the Year. This is written by Kate Kemp. After a hard-fought spring season, it's time to look back and recognize those who made the greatest impact on their team. These track stars shined throughout the season and had big performances at MIAA States, Meet of Champions, and some even at the national level. Check out the nominees for Boys Track and Field Athlete of the Year. Vote for who you think deserves the honor. Reader votes will make up 25% of the tally, with sports reporter Kate Kemp making up the rest of the vote. The poll will run until July 17th at noon. The nominees are Aurora Ankoma Mensah of Quabbin. Ankoma Mensah earned 2 second-place finishes at the MIAA Division V State Championship in the 100 meters and 200 meters. He was also part of Quabbin's 4x100 relay team that placed second at States. Then there's Jordan Bauman of Narragansett. Bauman is a consistent performer for the Warriors. He was first in the 110 hurdles at the Division VI State Championship and fifth in the event at the MIAA Meet of Champions. He also placed fourth in the long jump at States. A third candidate is the Gardner 4x800 relay team. The Wildcats 4x800 relay team placed ninth at the Division VI State Championship. Their strong performance was also record-breaking for the school record, a record that has stood since 2010. Members included in the relay team are Bradley Betez, Noah O'Toole, Sokari Jenkins, and Paul Fowley. The next nominee, Oakmont Sprint Medley Relay Team. Tegan Yoder, Jackson Deloge, Jackson Taylor, and Jaden Brostrom of Oakmont were eighth in the country at the Nike Nationals in the 1600 Sprint Medley Relay. Their impressive performance earned them All-American honors. Also in the competition, Silas Stekules Barrio of Quabbin. Stekules Barrio was ninth overall in the pentathlon at the MIAA Meet of Champions, his highest finish being fourth in the 1500 meters. Remember, the voting goes on through July 17th at the Gardner News website. And for your summer recreation, cool off this summer at these splash pads in central Massachusetts. This is written by Catherine Messier of USA Today Network, New England. Looking for a way the kids can cool off after the 4th of July heat wave? In addition to numerous public beaches and pools, central Massachusetts has multiple splash pads open this time of year, offering the perfect way for children to enjoy being in the water without the hassle of a beach day. While some are ticketed, many of the region's splash pads are free, with parks, playgrounds, and other recreational areas attached. Here are some splash pads where you can beat the heat this summer. The Park Hill Splash Park in Fitchburg. This small splash pad features rainbow rings to run through and a large sun design painted on the ground. The splash pad is part of Park Hill Park, which also has a skateboard park, 2 playgrounds, a basketball court, several baseball fields, and restrooms. Park Hill Splash Park is open from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. daily from June through August. Lifeguards are always on site and parking is available off Pratt Road in Fitchburg. Another is Fournier Park Splash Pad, located inside the Arthur A. Fournier Senior Memorial Park in Leominster. This splash pad spouts water from various flowers, a frog, and even a dragon. The water must be turned on by pressing an orange button on the pavilion side of the splash pad, and it runs for 12 to 14 minutes at a time. The splash pad is open daily from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. It continues through the summer until Labor Day. Fournier Park is located at 625 Litchfield Street in Leominster. Another opportunity, Cowabunga Splash Park. Davis Farmland in Sterling is back for a second year with Cowabunga Splash Park, the largest zero-depth water spray park in New England. The park features every kind of mister and sprinkler imaginable, including horse cannons, a water tunnel, a water table, a toddler spray pad, and more. The park also has a giant slip and slide, an inflatable water slide, and a huge water tower. Admission to Davis Farmland, which includes access to over 50 activities, costs $35.95 for adults or $32.95 for seniors over 60, though tickets cost more at the gate. It's open daily from 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. through Labor Day. And there's Philbin Memorial Park and Splash Pad in Clinton, a newly renovated splash pad that turns on by touching on top of the red fire hydrant. The water runs for 4 to 5 cycles, then rests for 10 to 15 minutes. Philbin's splash pad is open daily through Labor Day with hours from 9 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. It's located at Berlin and Wilson Streets in Clinton. This is Community News from Gardner. It's a weekly production of the Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Now with the final segment, here's Alexandra.
Thank you again, Dave. Fire at Templeton Auto auction site destroys dozens of vehicles. This is by Stephen Landry and Sandy Mendersma for the Gardner News. More than 60 vehicles were heavily damaged following an early morning fire at Insurance Auto Auctions, Templeton, on July 2nd. Gardner and Winchington Fire Departments provided mutual aid to the Baldwinville Road property after receiving a call for a reported fire with explosions. According to the Gardner Fire Department's Facebook page, upon arrival, crews found 12 vehicles fully engulfed in flames. The fire spread to 60 vehicles, most of which were totally destroyed. An auction was scheduled on-site for Thursday, July 2nd at 9:30 a.m. There were no reported injuries. 5 Revolutionary War leaders from Mass to know, plus where they're buried. This is by Catherine Messier, for the USA Today Network, New England. America celebrated its 250th anniversary this 4th of July. In Massachusetts, the birthplace of the American Revolution, is home to many key figures and events that helped form the nation. Along with multiple Declaration of Independence signers and early presidents, Massachusetts also produced many military leaders who played a significant role in the Revolutionary War, from the war's first commander-in-chief to its first major martyr. Here are 5 significant Revolutionary War leaders from Massachusetts, as well as how to visit their graves. Henry Knox. Born in Boston on July 25, 1750, Henry Knox was a bookseller who became well-known during the American Revolution for his expertise in military science, according to the National Park Service, NPS. Rising the ranks to Chief of Artillery, Henry Knox was present at many key revolutionary events, including the Boston Tea Party, the Battle of Bunker Hill, and the crossing of the Delaware River. Knox gained the attention of General George Washington during the Siege of Boston in 1775 through 76, where he designed crucial forts and transported about 60 tons of artillery from Fort Ticonderoga in the Noble Train of Artillery, allowing for the fortification of Dorchester Heights. He remained one of Washington's most trusted commanders through the end of the war at the 1781 Battle of Yorktown, where his direction of where to place siege artillery was instrumental in trapping the British and ultimately forcing their hand to surrender. After the war, Henry Knox went on to serve as the country's first Secretary of War under President George Washington. In 1794, Knox resigned his position and returned to his estate in what is now Maine. He passed away unexpectedly on October 25, 1806, at just 56 years old. Henry Knox is buried at the Thomastown Village Cemetery, open from dawn to dusk, at 15 Aaron Street in Thomastown, Maine. His grave is located in a small fenced-in area marked by a monument and plaque. Joseph Warren. Joseph Warren was born on June 11, 1741, in Roxbury. And, like many revolutionary figures in Massachusetts, attended Harvard University. According to the U.S. Army Center of Military History, Warren first gained the recognition of the political organization, the Sons of Liberty, in 1767, when he published a series of articles criticizing the Townsend Acts under a pen name. His recognition grew when many of his contemporaries went to the First Continental Congress in 1774, leaving Warren behind to serve on the Massachusetts Provincial Congress. In drafting the Suffolk Resolves, which Paul Revere carried to Continental Congress on horseback, says the Massachusetts Historical Society. Paul Revere is also known for his ride to warn of Britain's arrival before the war. It was actually Warren who received the notice of the British march on Concord and sent Revere on his midnight ride. In 1775, Continental Congress appointed him Major General, and 3 days later, he fought in the Battle of Bunker Hill. A musket ball struck him in the head during the battle, and Warren died an early death at just 34 years old. Although his career was cut short, Warren is remembered as the first major martyr of the Revolutionary War, and his courageous death fortified the colonists' cause. Today, Warren is buried at Forest Hill Cemetery in Jamaica Plain, with a statue atop a large rock marking his grave. The cemetery is open daily starting at 8 a.m. and is located at 95 Forest Hills Ave in Boston. Artemus Ward. Artemus Ward was born in Shrewsbury on November 26, 1727. After attending Harvard, he inherited his parents' farm and became involved in local government, according to the NPS. Ward joined the Massachusetts Militia in 1755, commanding troops during the French and Indian War. As tensions with Britain rose, Ward advocated in the Massachusetts legislature to purchase more weapons and supplies, helping to begin the enlistment process and setting up a military base in Cambridge after the Battle of Lexington and Concord. Ward was made Commander-in-Chief of the Massachusetts Forces in May of 1775, making him the first to hold that title during the Revolutionary War. After the failure to capture the peninsula during the Battle of Bunker Hill, he turned over command to General George Washington, with Ward remaining second in seniority as first major general. With Washington, Ward helped plan the siege of Boston, arguing for the importance of fortifying Dorchester Heights. After the successful siege, Ward submitted a letter of resignation in March 1776. Washington convinced him to stay through the following year, though the two never got along. After his military service, Ward served in Continental Congress from 1780 through 81, and Congress from 1791 through 95. He died on October 28, 1800, and was laid to rest in Mountain View Cemetery, open from dawn to dusk on Boylston Street in Shrewsbury. John Glover. Originally born in Salem in 1732, John Glover grew up in Marblehead, becoming one of the wealthiest and most well-known shipowners and merchants in the seaport town. A radical advocate for independence, Glover formed a regiment of 500 men from his town militia and the Marblehead seamen when war was approaching. According to the NPS, the regiment was one of the first integrated units, including Native Americans and African Americans. Glover and the Marbleheaders were ordered to New York, where they aided the evacuation of Washington's 9,000 soldiers, horses, and artillery by ship, without being noticed by the British. Glover was then sent to Pell's Point on Pelham Bay, where he successfully held off the British forces long enough for Washington to retreat to White Plains. After participating in the Battle of White Plains, Glover and his brigade crossed the Hudson River and reunited with Washington in New Jersey, where the Marbleheaders once again ferried thousands of troops and supplies, this time crossing the Delaware River in extreme weather conditions. In 1777, Glover was promoted to Brigadier General and joined the forces at Saratoga, eventually retiring from the army in July of 1782. Glover went on to serve as town selectman, a representative in the Massachusetts House, and a delegate to the Massachusetts Convention for ratifying the U.S. Constitution. John Glover passed away from a liver infection in 1794 at age 62. He is buried at Old Burial Hill Cemetery in Marblehead, open to the public during daylight. Benjamin Lincoln. According to the NPS, Benjamin Lincoln was born in Hingham on January 24, 1733, attending local schools before establishing his own farm. After starting in local politics as town clerk in 1757, he rose to prominence in both politics and military, achieving the rank of lieutenant colonel and a spot on the colonial legislature by 1772. Lincoln's service in the New York campaign in 1776 bought him General Washington's praise, and Lincoln was named a major general in the Continental Army in 1777. After successfully leading his men away from capture in the Battle of Bound Brook, Lincoln was sent to aid in the defense of the British march down the Hudson River from Fort Ticonderoga, where his ankle was shattered by a musket ball during a skirmish. After Lincoln recovered, in September of 1778, Continental Congress made him the new commander of Southern Department. Many of his Southern campaigns and battles were unsuccessful, including the surrender of Charleston in May 1780, the largest defeat of the American forces during the Revolution. Lincoln was exchanged soon after, serving as second in command to Washington during the Yorktown campaign. After the British surrendered, Washington refused to accept the surrendered sword from British Brigadier General Charles O'Hara and motioned toward Lincoln, who accepted the sword instead. Lincoln is one of a select few present at the war's three major surrenders, Saratoga, Charleston, and Yorktown. After the war, Lincoln continued public service, becoming a member of the Massachusetts State Convention to ratify the U.S. Constitution and leading a surprise attack against Shays' Rebellion, says the National Constitution Center. He served as the collector of the Port of Boston for about 20 years until he retired in 1809. Benjamin Lincoln passed away on May 9, 1810, and was buried at the Hingham Cemetery, also called the Old Ship Burying Ground, located at 12 South Street in Hingham. The cemetery is open to the public daily from dawn to dusk. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you'd like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-9600. 1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or you can go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Alexandra Zapantis. Thank you for listening.
Have you listened to one of Audio Journal's most popular shows, Talking Topics, with host Bill Ruggiero? You can catch it on the second weekend of each month, airing Saturday at 3 p.m. and again on Sunday at 6 p.m. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.